Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Dawn? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7pm here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live. Hello, I'm Denise.
I'm Martin.
And you're listening to The Film Show here on Sheffield Live.
Well, we're back. I was just going to suggest to Denise that I did something like saying, "Did you miss me?" Yeah. And then it was, that was very, very inappropriate. And not something we should do.
No, absolutely
so
not.
So I've scratched that.
Well, it's a good job you scratched it and told me about it before we went on air.
There you
go. Well done.
There you go. Because you would have responded.
I would have,
we
yes.
would have responded. Okay, so, yes, we're back. Both of us had a week off. Did you have a nice time?
Oh, I had a lovely time. Saw some lovely films.
Oh, me too. Well, after a fortnight ago, any film is going to be lovely from now on.
We're still scarred. We took the week off. We've recovered from the awfulness that is The Curse of the Film Show. Two films that were so dreadful.
Well, I say The Curse, as we've seen, that The Curse of the Film Show, we can officially say, is now active, because
yes, we have activated it.
If you remember, or if you turned off after 5 minutes of the last show we did, we were in a state of trauma from the two films we've been to see, Trap and Borderlands. But
now showing, no, not now showing,
not now
no.
showing in many cases, but the curse that we put on them has been shown to be absolutely devastating.
I mean, maybe they cursed themselves, Martin, don't you think?
No.
Their total inadequacy.
No, I think it may have just been that we
just
put
us.
And I'm only going by what was on at the Light, because I went to the Light yesterday. And M. Night Shyamalan's Trap was just on for one screening per day.
Yeah.
And Borderlands, there was no sign of. We seek it here. We seek it there. But you're not going to see it at the Light. And I just had a quick check round at other multiplex cinemas. Neither of them.
Yes, you're not seeing it in your droves,
no,
are you?
No.
Very wise.
So, we're very pleased about that.
Because, Martin, not everyone can take a week off when they've seen a bad film.
Exactly. We don't know how lucky we are.
No, absolutely.
Okay, so we've got... we've actually got a lot to get through, haven't we?
We have, yeah. That's what happens when you take a week off, you know.
Yeah, I know. Not going to be what you think it is.
No.
Bennifer.
R.I.P. Bennifer.
R.I.P.
Bennifer. It came back very briefly to provide some column inches in Variety and the Hollywood Reporter and the gossip
columns. If you don't know what it is we're talking about, we're talking about the sad demise of the marriage of Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez.
The second attempt was not successful.
You're going to go for a third?
They might
do. You always do these
things probably
in threes,
when they're in their
60s. You?
They're in the 50s now, aren't they? They'll probably come
back.
But
you do these things in a film. You know, you have to meet.
Maybe they're angling for like a Liz Taylor, Richard Burton type thing. Unfortunately, Ben Affleck has not got the gravitas of Richard Burton, but maybe that's what they're going for.
Yeah. I was almost tempted to dig out my DVD copy of Jiggly, if you remember that. Catastrophic film they made together.
I've never seen it, but you are strangely fond of it, I seem to remember.
It has its appeal, let's say, knowing you two ain't going to talk to each other anymore after this. But I was proved wrong. I at the end of it, I decided, no, sod it, I can't be bothered sitting through that again. But there you are, Ben Affleck, Jennifer Lopez. And I've just got to say, she strikes me as high maintenance.
Yeah, but maybe, I mean, do you know what? I still can never forget how much I loved her in Out of Sight with George Clooney.
She's
amazing in that. And I feel like it was just the right time of catching her at, before she was mega famous, but she was already successful. And she takes direction probably in that film, I think. It's just one of my favourite films.
And you can forgive her so
absolutely
much for
anything,
that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
She's done a lot since that is unforgivable. But, you know, you think, well, just outside is...
Just watch
that
outside.
Bit, that bit in the boot of the car. Is, you know,
And when she's in the bath thinking about him coming and finding her and, love it.
And it's got that lovely bit where Michael Keaton turns up in it as a character he was in Jackie Brown, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's like a bumbling FBI.
It's probably the only good moment in a from a Quentin Tarantino film. I think, oh, that was good.
Yeah,
but it's not to be.
No,
and all I can say is, I bet he's sitting at home thinking, "God, Jennifer Garner looks great in Deadpool versus Wolverine." What was I thinking?
Well, he doesn't strike me as a man who thinks much. To be honest,
he's got that sort of bit of a lunkhead.
Yeah.
Over to you.
Well, another something that's got movie Twitter, let's call it, movie Twitter and TikTok in a bit of a frenzy, which has also had an impact on, like, it gets reported then by Variety and Hollywood Reporter and stuff like that as real news. Bit of a Don't Worry Darling sort of vibe to it. So the Blake Lively, Ryan Reynolds is what we're talking about situation.
Cool.
So they are top of the American box office.
They certainly are.
With Deadpool versus Wolverine and a little film about a domestic violence adaptation of a big selling American book called It Ends With Us. Now, it's the kind of film that I just sort of noticed a bit and then went away and then suddenly there's this all hoo-ha about it. But it's directed by and lead starring Justin Baldoni as sort of the villainous boyfriend.
Never heard of him.
Doesn't matter.
Good.
I'll tell you the story anyway. Blake Lively stars as a florist, and this is one of the worst names I've ever heard in film. The florist is called Lily Bloom. She needs to bloom, Martin. Anyway, I step aside. The reason it came onto my radar is I saw an incredibly misjudged, and it's about 5 minutes long, and I've tried to show you a clip, but we just couldn't get through it. But it's a really misjudged, like, promo for a film that's about domestic violence. And it's Ryan Reynolds supposedly turning up on, like, a PR to interview the actor who is, like, the good guy in the film, not Justin Baldoni, who also directed it. And he's interviewing him as he is Blake Lively's husband, talking about how this guy is kissing his wife on screen and isn't that a bit cheeky. Then, inexplicably, his mum turns up to interview her as the mother-in-law.
Ryan Reynolds' mum.
Yeah, as the mother-in-law of Blake Lively, going, this guy shouldn't be kissing my daughter on screen. And then Hugh Jackman, who happens to be starring in Deadpool versus Wolverine with Ryan Reynolds. Ryan Reynolds, not in the film. Ryan Reynolds' mum, not in the film. Hugh Jackman, not in the film.
She might have been in Deadpool. There were so many Deadpools at the end.
They're doing this sort of funny, like, skit about how they wanted to hate this guy and then they love him. And then it's just so misjudged. So misjudged. And then there's lots of, like, clips on Twitter and stories about how Blake Lively is a terrible person. There's rumours about Justin Baldoni not being getting on with the other cast and being ostracised for them. And the key thing, no one follows him on Instagram or Twitter, you know, in the cast. It's just very, very, like, someone reading into something and getting all of the 2 + 2 and coming up with 72. But there's obviously something gone on the set.
Yeah.
And in all the publicity and at the premiere, he is not photographed with them. But she turns up with Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman. Like, what is going on? There's all of this negative stories come out. But then it turns out that he hired the PR crisis manager, who's called Melissa Nathan, also known in Hollywood circles for being the PR for one Johnny Depp during the Amber Heard case.
No!
So where has all this negative stories come up all of a sudden? Like a 5-year-old interview with someone where she calls the interviewer fat because she's called her fat. You know, it's just kind of...
Puerile.
And it just made me... I find it interesting in a way because it's a storm in a teacup that's blown over. You haven't heard anything about it because you don't get involved in the stupid minutiae of Hollywood gossip.
Well, I mean, I do. It's just one that sailed past me. I couldn't...
But, you know, it's worked. They are number 1 and 2 in the American box office, but their reputation, which already was a bit like... I think they got married on a plantation, which was... very misjudged. So they're already a bit questionable.
They're going to be the most hated couple in Hollywood, aren't they, by Christmas?
For the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. No, I think this is a downward spiral.
Yeah.
I do.
So you don't think any more Deadpool as a result of this? I think he'll come out of it unscathed.
I think they will, because it's made so much money, hasn't it? But it's like, I don't know.
But it's just,
not a benefit. What is it? Rye Blake? Blakery. Blakery.
It's Blakery.
Blakery.
Tim
Blakery
going on.
Blakery.
Blake Foolery going on. But it just interested me how many...
That, by the way.
How many, like, column inches it generated and,
Waffle.
But it worked for the film. Although I can't face watching it, so...
Yes, well... trailer trash.
What we got?
There is a... expanded trailer for Coppola's Megalopolis in theatres now, which you see a lot more of the ancient Rome parallels, don't you, in this trailer? But there's also, there has been another trailer which ran into some trouble wasn't it?
It's fascinating as well.
Yeah.
Like, who puts these things together and think nobody checks them? Who misquotes the great
She's done in the land of Donald Trump, remember?
Yeah,
so don't have to check any
it's
of that.
It's fascinating, isn't it? So they put this, for those that aren't aware, they put another trailer together, which is obviously someone in a room somewhere has gone, well, Cannes hated the film. How can we still make people come and see it? Ah, we'll tell them that critics hated all of his other films, including his most venerated film, The Godfather. And I think they included a quote attributing it to Pauline Kael, where, I mean, Pauline Kael famously, with anyone that knows about film in the 70s in Hollywood knows that she loved the film.
Yeah.
And they attributed a bad quote to her. And someone went, well, if they've got that quote wrong, what else is there? And
exactly.
It's all just made up quotes.
Critics, what do they know?
Yeah.
It's like us two sitting here talking about films every Saturday. And
we've never even met Blake Lively.
No. Begging her to come on the show, but she said no, she's no.
But it's so patronising and rude that you would put that together.
Yeah.
What a misfire. But still, the images in the proper trailer.
Yeah,
there's a lot going on there, isn't there?
Unfortunately, Adam Driver still seems to be in it. So that's something that's putting me off still. But
I love Adam Driver. Adam Driver can turn up in 20 Shades of Rubbish and I'd be like, yeah, but it's still Adam Driver. Yeah. I sat through a net, don't forget, and loved it.
You will also be accosted by an expanded trailer for the second Joker film, Folie à Deux.
Lady Gaga.
Lady Gaga. And
love her.
She's and you see a lot more of it. And I must say, visually, it looks astonishing.
I even just love the poster.
Yeah. Mm. So I'm really looking forward to this still.
Me too.
Yeah.
Oh, we're not cynical anymore.
Oh, God. Oh, look. and the only other thing I had to say was there's all these trailers for Terminator 7. End of War, and Terminator 7, Future War, Terminator 7, Final War.
Are these the real deal? Or?
These seem to be like cobbled together with AI by various fans out there.
Okay.
Apparently they are writing a script for another Terminator film. And John Cena seems to be in all of these things. I don't
Is this
know how
a fan
we got
wish?
Into it. It's one of these sort of things. Oh, wouldn't it be good if John Cena was in it? there's Arnie. And there's bits from all like other films that he's made recently where he's an old man. There's, you know, computer-generated things of John Cena. There's clips from other films of explosions and aliens.
Old people like us might think it's the real thing, Martin.
I know, I did. I tried to book a ticket for it and was laughed at. So, that's it.
We need a new category of trailer trash trash. This isn't actually
this
trailer
is, this
trash.
Really is
trash.
This really is trash.
Trash.
Yes, yes. I was going to... But then I thought, is there too many trashes? Oh, I have to leave it. Okay, well, music. After your mind-boggling selection of party tunes...
Oh, my
tunes,
gosh, I knew you were going to do this.
I was just saying.
Martin's picked you a proper film that you've never heard of.
I've got the score from a film. That's his film music that was composed for the film. Not that there was anything wrong with that playlist you did.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but he's not going to let me live it down.
No. I've played the CD that playlist was on once since we played it. Anyway, I'm taking selections from the score of Camille 2000, an art house softcore film from 1969, which isn't a mucky film at all. It's at that period where European films were able to show a lot more nudity
than the prudish Americans.
Sauciness than what Hollywood
films.
Oh,
I like the way you said sauciness.
It's almost French, isn't it? and you're going to think, oh, what's he been watching? Camille 2000 is a gorgeous, gorgeously romantic film with it's in Technicolor, it's in CinemaScope, and it has the most amazing score by the Italian composer Piero Piccioni. And it's based on Alexandre Dumas novel, Lady of the Camellias, is it? I think. And...
It sounded a bit operatic.
I think
there's plot for it when I looked it up.
Yeah, and it's set amongst the wild and swinging jet set of Rome, supposedly at the end of the 20th century, and it stars Danielle Gautier, a French actress whose life story is worth its own film. She was married to the son of a Dominican Republic dictator.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, she was. She started off as a young nymphette in the early 60s in French cinema. Married the South American dictator's son, He kicked her out of the house after she'd had two kids, left her with no money.
Oh, my gosh.
She had to go back to acting.
Has there been a film of her life?
There needs to be.
There must
I ain't
have
finished.
Been.
I'm nowhere near
oh
finished.
We've got four songs to get through. And a
oh,
lot
no,
to
no,
get
no.
Come
yeah,
on.
Well, they're short ones. Not like the...
All right.
Where was I? Right. So she comes back and she makes Camille 2000, which is one of these films, which are these sort of swinging jet set movies that are being made around Europe.
And it's French, but she's Italian.
She's French. The director is American,
right.
Radley Metzger, who made a series of these real high production value films. There's another great one called The Licorice Quartet. I'll leave that there.
Yeah.
and so while she's in Europe at this time, she meets French skiing champion Jean-Claude Killy. Do you remember him?
She sounds like a Bond.
She should have been
character.
A Bond girl. Yeah, she missed a chance. Mm. And she marries Jean-Claude Killy. And her final film is a heist movie set in the Alps with a lot of skiing. And the star of the film with her is Jean-Claude Killy. This is crying out for a movie, isn't it?
There must be one already. We'll have a look.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to play a selection of Piero Piccioni's music from the film. And believe me, I've got more to tell you about this film as we go on. And this is the main title. It's a really lovely big beat loungecore classic. So get your dancing shoes on.
Get ready.
Yeah.
Thank you.
listening to The Film Show on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM, online and on digital. And I'm Denise.
I'm Martin.
And we've got some more news, but sad news this week. Get the bell ready. So we have to commemorate the passing of, a couple of screen greats. We're going to start with Jenna Rowlands.
Yes, I'd always call her Gina, but you've corrected me on that.
Well, that's what she called herself, and apparently you say she was wrong, but I'm not going to tell her.
I need to mansplain her name to her.
But one of the most innovative, inventive, emotive, amazing actors of Hollywood. She was born in 1930, had quite a comfortable middle-class family upbringing, went to drama school, American Academy of Arts in New York. In interviews, she stated quite a lot she did not want to be a film actor or get married because that would interfere with her career. She had an interest in going into the theatre, I think, mostly, which she did do as well. But she didn't want to be distracted from her craft by anything as minor as a relationship or marriage. She met John Cassavetes at the Academy, and they were married. They formed a professional and personal partnership that lasted until his death in 1989. Her first appearances were in some classic US TV in the 50s and 60s era. I think she had regular slots on Peyton Place, but she was in shows like Laramie, Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
If you're watching old TV on something like Talking Pictures, you'd be amazed where she turns up in a show.
They moved out to Hollywood. They had a young family. And basically, they collaborated on a lot of films together. And he wrote parts for her. I think the most significant first film was Faces, which they filmed in their own house in between other acting jobs. Because he, obviously...
Well, Cassavetes is going to do a job. Like, he's in the Dirty Dozen.
Yeah.
Well, he's only in the Dirty Dozen because he was getting paid well.
They used that to fund own filmmaking.
Product, yeah.
And he was a truly independent filmmaker and she was a truly independent film actress. Faces is quite a difficult watch now. I think it was filmed in about 1965, came out in 1968. It sort of cemented their relationship together on screen, I think. Where it's not an easy one. I watched it the other week and I hadn't seen it before, and it's very of its time. But it's also, she is stunning in this film.
Yeah.
Absolutely stunning.
Her hair. I'm just obsessed.
Yeah.
And I'm not being superficial here, but her hair is just,
So other films, like notable films, I think if you've only ever seen one film of hers and John Cassavetes, it's probably going to be Woman Under the Influence.
Yeah.
Which was 1974. She was Oscar nominated for that. I think that year it went to Ellen Bernstein for Us, Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Faye Dunaway was also up that year for Chinatown. So these are sort of her contemporaries at the time. But she, I think another film with Cassavetes was Gloria in 1980, where she plays like a mob girlfriend who inadvertently ends up saving the life of a young child whose family has been hit by the mob.
I mean, that was probably Cassavetes, of the films that he made himself, his most well-known and profitable. But she's sensational in it isn't she?
She's so, like, she has that on screen, vulnerable yet strong.
Yeah.
And you can see what she's thinking. Every scene is an intention, and her physicality is amazing.
Oh, God. I mean, there's a couple of action sequences in it that she is involved in, and it's like, she turns on a switch, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And one minute she's... And, I mean, all of these mafia guys are all of a sudden very, very scared of her, aren't she? She pulls out a gun.
She takes them all on.
Yeah.
There's a line in it where I think she says, come on, take me on, I'd love it.
Yeah,
and it's a bit
love it.
It's a bit like that Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry quote, do you feel lucky, punk?
Yeah.
It's like... You know, if justice were done for women in cinema, it would be as famous as that. But she did a lot of other TV work, like to fund stuff through. And one of the most... I saw a clip of her talking about her... she was accepting her Oscar. She's never won an Oscar for Best Actress, but she did like get the Governor's Award one year. She tells a lovely little anecdote in that about working with one of her heroes on The Stranger, Betty Davis, which was a 1979 Emmy Award-winning TV film where they played mother and daughter. I haven't actually seen the film because I can only find a really grainy version on YouTube that's not really worth the looking at. But she does a funny little anecdote about Betty Davis. I mean, by the time she's working with her, she must be nearly 50 herself. It's not like she's a spring chicken. Yeah. And that is what Betty Davis reminds her of in this anecdote about looking at the dailies, about the rushes. But talk about turning on a switch. She was in most recent, well, fairly recently, relatively recently, from 20 years ago, The Notebook, which any... My friend Louise absolutely loved The Notebook because she fell in love with Ryan Reynolds. But it's basically a flashback story, and James Garner plays the older version of Ryan Reynolds, who is trying to remind his Alzheimer's-suffering wife in home who she is and who he is by reading her this story of their life from The Notebook.
She actually... suffered with Alzheimer's at
the
end of her life.
Yeah, they very respectfully only really announced that I think Nick Cassavetes, her son, who directed her in The Notebook, just announced that relatively recently. She'd been like dealing with it for like the last 5 years or so, I think. Which, you know, she was in 94 when she died. One of the sad things about getting older is we're more vulnerable to stuff like that, aren't we, as we get older. But what a life on film.
It's quite,
and what
I mean,
a life. She lived her life independently and doing her art.
And it's one of those things, you know, she can turn up in a film, and quite often she's just playing a supporting role in some films, and that'll be the best 5 minutes of that film. You think, what?
Yeah, well, there's a film, I can't remember the name of it, which this is a bad story, but Michael J. Fox plays her son in it, and Joan Jett plays her daughter.
Paul Schrader.
It's amazing. Like, I've seen clips of it. I haven't seen the whole thing.
It's a great, great movie.
But that's just a TV film. And I mean, Joan Jett. And that's another mother-daughter relationship with the film. But I did see a very emotive clip with her and the daughter, like a reconciliation scene with them both.
It's, again, that's one of those lost films. And it's very hard to find a copy of. But she's... again, she's not in it that long, but just the emotion that she brings to that bit of film is incredible.
I think we need a bit of a decent box set out for some of us that want to see those old films.
And then people would understand what we're talking about.
Yeah, well, sometimes you can see it on YouTube, but it's not the same experience.
But sometimes, if you need to see it, that's how you got to do it.
Yeah.
Is it me now?
It is you, yeah.
I curtailed it. like I was mixing it. Alain Delon, the most handsome man in the world for
apparently
a certain period, it said here. The great French film star passed away last weekend. He was 88, I believe. A absolutely spectacular career he had as probably one of the leading actors of French cinema. His career spanned from the New Wave, although he didn't really appear in any New Wave movies. He tried out in Hollywood a few times, but it never really worked. But he made so many films in France and so many landmark films during his career. He never trained as an actor. But he was spotted at the Cannes Film Festival in 1956 by a producer who just thought, "That guy's gorgeous. We've got to." Happened to me once.
We chose to live a different life.
But now I took my mask off, and they weren't interested. And shortly afterwards, Delon makes his impact on screen, and probably his first big role was in Purple Noon or Plein Soleil, a Jacques a René Clément film from 1959, where he's the first actor to play Tom Ripley. Mm. So this film is the first version of the talented Mr.
Well,
Ripley.
Yeah.
And he makes a huge impact in there. And he then goes on to be used by a number of great directors, certainly during the early 60s. He's used by Visconti in Rocco and His Brothers and The Leopard. Antonioni uses him in The Eclipse. And so he builds up this sort of solid body of working for major directors. And then he's used by the French director Jean-Pierre Melville, who specialises in crime movies. And you've probably got one of Delon's most, I hate using the word, but I'll say iconic roles in Les Samouraïs.
You get one per month, that's that used up.
Yep, that's it, thank you. It's the end of August.
Yeah, it'll be all right.
And in The Samouraï, he is, you know, a cool-as-ice hitman, never breaks into a smile or anything, and he's wearing a trench coat with the collar turned up, a trilby, and he's got an automatic in a shoulder holster underneath his coat. And
Le flic.
That's a cop, that is. Yeah. And he's a cop in so many. And he goes between being a criminal and a cop very easily.
Yeah.
And again, that is one of his greatest roles. And he's sort of so ice cold in this, where he displays no emotion. His character is very, very emotionless. And I think some of this carried over in some ways to his life outside of film, where some of the stuff he did could be seen as quite questionable.
Yes.
He seemed to be a difficult man to get on with. He had a child with Nico, her of the Velvet Underground, and he refused.
Also iconic.
That's yours. he never recognised the birth of Harry, never played any part in his life. And Harry, I think, eventually died from a drug overdose.
Oh, dear.
Well, not surprising when Nico's your mum, I might say. Mm. But and there was all sorts of shenanigans to do with his family, which came to a head during this week when the funeral arrangements were trying to be sorted out.
And yeah, they were squabbling in the lead up to his death as well. It's saying one of the daughters was taken over.
There were some fights over the will. And then he insisted,
because we're talking like chateau, like inheritance.
Yes,
here, aren't we?
Yeah. And he's being buried in the grounds of his chateau, in a private crypt,
but not with his dog.
Not with his dog, Ludo. Mm. Now this is where must admit,
this is intense.
I'm quite liking Alain Delon about this. He wanted Ludo to be put down and put in the coffin with him.
Goodness.
I'm like, come on, what a guy. Listeners will be pleased to know that's not happening. Ludo lives. We'll just leave you with, if you want to see a film of Delon, certainly in his prime, mm-hmm. We've both watched Mr. Klein, haven't we, this
yes,
week?
Yes, your recommendation to me, because I'm familiar with him. I knew his name.
Yeah, he's one of these actors.
I'd never seen him in anything. But I watched it last night, Mr. Klein.
Which is directed by Joseph Losey. Yeah. And that's a terrific movie.
Kafka-esque.
Yes.
1942, occupied France.
He's playing a very questionable character who's buying the valuables off of Jewish families.
Who've got no choice but to try and flee. Yeah. And this is just before they're all impounded.
Yeah. I won't say any more because that really builds up to the end of it. So, quite a
devastating ending, though.
Oh, God, it's. So that's one to try and catch. And if not, maybe Les Samouraïs. It'll be a good one.
You can watch Mr. Klein on Amazon Prime, can't you?
Can you?
Yeah.
Oh, of course, you're pointed out.
Mm. Yeah.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
So there's your viewing for the week. And we're going to have another track from Camille 2000. During one of the tastefully shot sex scenes, this one shot in an all-white room with lots of mirrors. Oh. And this track is Poils.
To the film show 93.2 FM with me, Denise.
Me, Martin.
And that was Martin.
That was Piero Piccioni's Pearls from the score of Camille 2000.
Now, from Martin's introduction, I was imagining lots of very naughty things going on in a white room, but Martin tells me it's all very tastefully done.
Very tastefully done. The Junior Anti-Sex League won't be able to close us down or anything of that one.
We're going to go on to some reviews now, aren't we?
Please, let's.
Yeah. I went to see a couple of films because, you know, I've had a couple of weeks off. I had a binge yesterday. I went to see yesterday Blink Twice. So this is the directorial debut by Zoe Kravitz, daughter of Lisa Bonet and Mr. Lenny Kravitz, international superstar rock star.
Are you going to go my way? That one.
Yep. That guy.
That one.
She is a very accomplished actor in her own right already. I quite liked her in the TV series Big Little Lies.
Yes, she was great in that.
She is, like, so I know you get the whole Nepo baby idea, but I think she's done her dues, if you know what I mean, acting wise. But this is her directorial debut. It is Channing Tatum plays this tech billionaire who is also
there's been a little lemon in the news this week.
Yeah, who is also, it happens to be, Zoe Kravitz's fiance. Didn't know that.
In real
before
life.
I watched the film, in the life of realness, yes. Which I worry about how she's cast him in this and seeing this very, 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 very dark side of him. Basically, you've got Naomi Aki as Frida and her friend Jess, played by Alaya Shawkat. They are waitresses and they get this over and done with very quickly, the setup. They're waitresses at a fancy gala dinner. She's got her eye on this Channing Tatum character, and they get whisked away to his holiday island. And that's done in the opening 5 minutes. Business out the way. They're on an island.
We're not giving anything away. There,
no, they're accepted by all of these highfalutin people. Obviously, there is no such thing as a free holiday on an island, but it's like a dream. They have their clothes provided. They have lots of fun lazing around, endless champagne. The evenings look like hedonistic fun, but no sex. No, they just wake up and carry on with this dream lifestyle, the life of the super rich.
Lovely.
Obviously, there's more to it than that, and the young women eventually figure out something more sinister is going on. For all of the sort of cheesiness of the setup and the billionaire island and whatever, I'm going to give this a gentle rate because although it's not like there's a lot of stuff you might see coming. The ending might not be massively satisfactory, but it's quite grim in places. And it gets quite, I mean, there is trigger warning, sexual violence is represented in this, but it is from the eye of a female director. And it's all about the sort of trauma. There's obviously other levels as well. They're on this sort of Mexican island, so there's sort of a race element of all of the staff are Mexican. Obviously, Naomi Aki is a young black woman. There's all of the differences in wealth. It's not quite as satirically... I mean, it is. It was obviously written and directed by somebody who has got a bit of an experience of a nice, lavish lifestyle.
Yeah.
So the satire is not as biting as maybe... It's not Ken Loach satire, but it's still like quite an involving film. The plot goes on quite nicely. And I think what makes it for me is Naomi Aki's performance and Adria Arjona, who is another one of the girls on the island, who is... there's so many big names drop up as well, but they're not just in it for the sake of being a big name. So you've got Christian Slater, you've got Gina Davis, Haley Joel Osment, and they all... I want Kyle MacLachlan does a little cameo in it
oh,
as well.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It's quite an entertaining. I think it's raised. I think the level of it is raised by the quality of the performance.
Yeah.
If I'm honest, but it is quite stylishly done, and I'm interested to see what else she comes up with. So I'm going to give that a gentle rate.
Okay. Mm. Well, I went to see Alien Romulus. The seventh film in the Alien franchise. I'm sorry, but I don't recognise Alien versus Predator and Alien versus Predator 2.
I gave up after Aliens, love.
They're just filmed that ruined two good franchises, as far as I'm concerned. So argue about that at home, but you'll just be shouting at the radio. Anyway, this new film, Alien Romulus, is produced by Ridley Scott. And it's directed by the Uruguayan director Fede Alvarez. And it's set between, time-wise, between Alien and Aliens. So it's about someone has found the Nostromo, which was drifting in space, probably with some aliens on it. And they've taken one of these life forms, and it's in this space station, which is circling this mining planet, which our heroine, Kaylee Spaney, who is in probably every film that's out at the moment. She's been in Civil War, Priscilla, and now this. So she's having a good run. But she's working on this mining town, this mining planet, where it's almost impossible to get out of your contract to get off. and her and a few friends discover there's this space station, and they decide to go there, get some of the pods which would allow them to be put to sleep and go somewhere else. It's a bit contrived, but so this starts off quite good, and it's we're on these spaceships that are like Alien, very very heavy industrial, and it was going pretty well. But then I found the second half, once the aliens are out, it turns into a bit of a greatest hits movie, where situations, dialogue, you know, someone does say, take your hands off her, you bitch, at one point.
Really?
Really?
The greatest hits of Alien, yeah, part one.
But, you know, like, all these, oh yeah, they did that in that, and they did that in there, and they did that in there. And then, of course, and I'm going to say this, turn the volume down for 30 seconds if you want, but this is in everything that's being written about.
Yeah, so it's
about
a bit of a spoiler. It's a nice surprise if you can have it. So.
Yeah, but it's been out a week as well, so, you know, keep up. who should pop up but Ian Holm?
The late
Ian
great
Holm.
Ian Holm,
As Officer Rook, who was obviously had his head smashed off in Alien, and he is computer generated. It's a combination of computer generated imagery and animatronics, and he becomes a key character within it. So by the end of it, it went on for far too long. You know, climax after climax after climax after climax. So just get to the end, and you'll be pleased to know that, yeah, there's still mileage in there being another one after this. So it was good for it getting back to basics. There's a very small cast and a very young cast, which was quite refreshing. So again, I'm going to give it a qualified rate. I'm leaving it there.
Okey-cokey. Well, I very much enjoyed another film I saw yesterday, which was out on general release this week, Kneecap. Now, Kneecap is an Irish-British film. It is... Now, so Kneecap are a real Irish hip-hop band.
They were on at Glastonbury, weren't they?
I believe so.
I believe they were.
They've been going since about 2017, and this is a sort of fictional story of them with a few truths thrown in. The main truths are that the three lead actors are the members of the group who are not actors. They are Irish hip-hop singers. But they are surrounded by a very, very competent supporting cast, including Mr. Michael Fassbender, who plays the father of one of them. And Josie Walker, who you might not know the name of, but she originated the part of Jamie's mum, and everybody's talking about Jamie. She is a fantastic theatre actor. She plays a particularly vicious detective in it.
Michael Fassbender is very good at working with these young filmmakers, where it's on extremely low budget
films.
There is
an incredibly funny... I mean, the humour is quite black in it. And they call themselves like the Peace Generation from Northern Ireland. So they're born after the peace process. But obviously, it's not... Life isn't simple, let's just say. It's sort of the rise of their hip-hop act and the things they are up against. It is anarchic in its humour. There is lots of heavy drug taking in the film, but it's very funny. They rap in their native Irish and they lead... they sort of lead... Everyone's against them. The people that want the Irish language back, the radical... Republicans against drugs are against them, and the authorities are against them. It's just, I had a whale of a time watching this film,
I give it a
very good rate.
Yeah. Yeah.
The humour in it is very black, very funny, high rate.
Good.
Oh, I mentioned it's directed by Rich Papayet, who was, it's his first feature documentary, but he did do a documentary, film. The One Rogue Reporter documentary, where he targeted editors of newspapers for their own treatment. It's about 10 years ago. he was himself a Daily Star reporter, and he's now living in Belfast and directing. And he directed one of their music videos and ended up doing this.
I'm just looking at the time. We've run over terribly here. So can we have the briefest of run-throughs of what's on next week?
Are we going to skip a track?
And then we'll end with the third track, yeah.
Fair dues.
So coming up next week, and I know hardly anything about any of these.
Well, Chaos is coming out on Netflix next week. It is
a modern take on Greek mythology.
Yeah, now I went to a comp, so whenever there's any quiz questions about Greek gods, I've got no clue. I think if I knew Jeff Goldblum was Zeus,
you would king have taken of all the classics gods,
I'd have got it. Yeah. It's got such a fabulous cast: Janet McTeer, Billy Piper, David Thewlis. It looks like high production values. It's like an 8-part TV series. It's created and directed by Charlie Covell, who did End of the Effing World. Looks great. So that looks interesting. Yep. New releases at the cinema. You've got a French film, The Count of Monte Cristo.
Is that a version of the Dumas novel?
But it's actually en France, but in English, about the start of Champagne as we know it, Widow Clicquot. What else we got coming out? Sing Sing. And Touch.
Sing Sing, the one about the prisoners?
Yes.
With their daughters?
Yes. It's when I saw the trailer for it, I was like, is this a documentary or is it a drama? It looks very intriguing. It is a drama, but it seems documentary in style. What else we got? We've got some one-offs. So if you're looking forward to Beetlejuice, the new Beetlejuice coming out on the 6th of September, you can see the original Beetlejuice at the Light all next week.
Empire Strikes Back.
And Terminator is celebrating its 40th anniversary, and that's on both at the Showroom and the Light.
And that's getting ready for Terminator 7, whenever that may come out, which is just a rumour at the moment. Okay, we're going to finish off with a final selection from the score of Camille 2000 by Piero Piccioni. And this is from the legendary party sequence, which if you Google Camille 2000 party scene, you can watch in its entire glory. Be warned, there is some nudity in it. So put the kids to bed early.
All very tastefully done.
Right. This is Chains. We'll see you next week.
See you next week. Enjoy your films.